Before we begin the next chapter, I just want to thank you for all the amazing reviews you've written. They really warm my heart, give me the confidence I need, and help this show find new listeners. So thank you so much. And also thank you to all of my patrons. This show is commercial-free and will remain that way, but you can support my creative process by becoming a patron. Visit sonofelpodcast.com/support. It's only a little bit each month, but it makes a big difference, especially in helping me believe in myself. I love telling this story and appreciate you enabling me to keep telling it. So thank you, and enjoy the show. You're listening to Book 2 of Superman, Son of El. He is more than a story. He is more than a comic book superhero. He is more than a symbol of hope. He represents our greatest aspirations. He is everything we think we can be. And yet, even with all the strength and all the power in all of the world, he may not be able to meet his greatest challenges and redeem his family's legacy. For he is the Son of El. Chapter 8, Crossing the Line. In the months after birthing their twin sons, Joseph and Jerome, Lana's well-being seemed to ride a constant wave of ups and downs. The burden of nursing these two hungry babies taxed her body and her spirit. Clark did all he could to aid her in caring for their sons. He felt guilty for neglecting his family while he was rescuing the Justice League from Kal-El. Yet with his friend's return, Clark could devote his attention to Lana and the boys. Kara was back, and eager to help in holding the babies. Yet even with her and Martha's doting attention and assistance, Clark put foresting the world on hold to spend some time watching his children grow. Even at their tender young age, the boys were showing a distinct difference in disposition. While Joseph displayed little interest in anything beyond his immediate grasp, Jerome was inclined to lunge from his parents' arms in hopes of ensnaring any pretty thing that caught his eye. When it came time to start crawling, Jerome was first, dragging himself by his arms and throwing himself on a whim toward any destination he desired. Meanwhile, Joseph saw little need for crawling and was content to gaze into mundane objects as though they revealed profound visions to him. When he needed to get somewhere, he rolled. As they grew, the two of them learned from each other, adopting one another's techniques until they made an indistinguishable hybrid of a movement. By 6 months old, they scurried around the house like lithe animals. During this time, Clark couldn't leave them for long without them climbing on the furniture and bounding up bookshelves. By 9 months, their acrobatic tumbling style of crawling transitioned into a stumbling run. Though they did not appear to be superpowered, Joseph and Jerome continued to develop well ahead of their age group. Their minds were just as advanced as their bodies. Lana was the first to notice how the twins took what little sign language they were taught, basic signing like hungry, thirsty, more, and all done, and were using it to communicate with one another.
"Did you see that, Clark? Those aren't signs we taught them."
Clark had noticed. Joseph and Jerome's sign language was something the two of them evolved together. It was imperceptible to nearly everyone, though their parents caught glimpses of it every now and then. Without having seen this communication technique develop, Clark would have thought the two boys spoke to one another telepathically. Even still, he wondered sometimes. Based on his own experiences, it seemed probable that telepathy could just as likely be a part of it. When the boys began to speak out loud, Joseph had the most to say at home, naming the objects he spotted around the house, yet he seemed mute to anyone beyond his parents, grandma, and Auntie Kara. Even Kara rarely saw his personality shine. Around her, he clammed up, while Joseph, on the other hand, was eager to impress their aunt. He had plenty of opportunities to impress her as Clark found himself often calling for Kara to babysit. If Clark wanted to get any permaculture work in, he needed her level of ability to keep up with his baby boys. Thankfully, Kara was eager to spend time with her nephews. With little free time to spare, Clark's tree planting had become relatively sparse. Yet even still, since beginning his efforts to cultivate new forests, he was seeing deserts around the world starting to turn green. Ground covers were beginning to flourish and Clark's tree planting was entering a new phase of growth. While expanding the woods he had begun cultivating along the Sahara Desert, Clark received an unexpected summons from John Jones. Jean contacted him telepathically to relay a message. Clark's cousin, Arthur, was in need of his aid. Arthur was not in immediate danger, yet there had been a tragedy, and Jean thought Aquaman was in need of some help. Clark cut his workday short to seek out his cousin in the city of Atlantis. Taking several deep breaths before plunging into the sea, Clark did as his cousin instructed, slipping between coral-covered archways and ocean-floor tunnels to part between planes of existence into the realm of Atlantis. The city glowed in a rainbow of illuminated colors. Clark smiled in awe of its beauty. The arrival of Superman in his radiant glory did not go unnoticed by the Atlanteans. They greeted him immediately and escorted him to a great undersea castle, where, to Clark's relief, awaited a chamber full of breathable air. Clark didn't have to wait long before an official introduced himself as Nuitus Volko. Volko greeted him in a language Clark recognized, though he'd never heard it before, much like Kryptonian. The man asked Clark his official business, yet when Clark told him he was there to see Arthur, his face showed deep distress. The old Atlantean let his reluctance fall away.
"Perhaps you can help."
Volko left for a few minutes, but soon returned.
"If you will follow me, the king will see you now."
Volko led Clark swimming through the palace, its walls shimmering like abalone shells. Weaving through its immaculate architecture, they arrived at another large chamber of air. At its center, Arthur awaited. Sitting in a small steaming pool set into the floor, his face forlorn. Clark eased himself into the tub. It was quite hot. Saying nothing, he awaited Arthur to speak. After Volko left the room, Arthur looked to his cousin, struggling to find the words.
Have you heard?
Clark shook his head. Aquaman looked away.
Little Arthur. Junior. He...
Clark's heart plummeted in his chest, skipping a beat and then racing. His breath was taken from him all at once as he whispered,
"Is he all right?"
Arthur stared at the floor surrounding the tub a moment before answering.
No, he was killed.
Clark's chest tightened. Even in the hot water, he became chilled. As a father, the thought of losing his children filled him with dread. He looked to his cousin, and his heart swelled with grief.
"Arthur, I'm so sorry. How?
Dude, it's so messed up. This dude, Black Manta, he said he did it as, like, revenge for stealing his kid. He thinks it's some form of justice."
"Stealing his kid? What?"
"Garth, when we adopted him, no one knew who his dad was. His mom was like family, so we made the little dude our family. But Black Manta had some crazy plan for the kid." And
Arthur choked up on his words, sinking into the hot water. When he came back up, Clark moved over and gave him a hug. Arthur broke down and wept into Clark's arms, tears running from his face, just as hot as the water. Clark held Arthur until he sat upright, washed his face once more, and climbed out of the tub. Clark followed him out.
"Where's Garth now?"
"Mara. She took him with her. They've gone into hiding."
Arthur was too shy to tell Clark any more. Instead, he offered to show his cousin around the palace and surrounding city. It was an obvious distraction, but it allowed for moments where a little reflection might slip by. Clark stayed with his cousin for hours until he needed to be home in Kansas. That night, reluctantly, Clark shared this news with Lana. Word of the tragedy hit her like a threat to her own children. She got up in agitation and began clearing the table. Clark had learned to savor the trouble. Before she could grab another plate, he had the table cleared and the dishes in the dish rack. She turned to Clark and he took her plate and fork from her, but she put her hands on her hips, disgruntled.
"I was going to clean those to distract myself. Now what am I supposed to do?"
Clark laughed at her jest, continuing to clean the kitchen. His humor lightened her distress as she prepared the twins for bed, brushing their tiny teeth and reading them a story. When Clark and Lana finally lay down for the night, they found their concerns returning to Arthur, Mara, and Garth. Lana urged Clark to visit more and invite them to do the same.
I've no doubt they're feeling worlds worse than we can ever imagine. Whatever we can do to get them through this, we gotta try. I only met Mara that one time, but she is the sweetest. And that poor little baby, he lost his brother. You tell them they're all welcome here.
Clark heard Lana's advice, yet he wondered what good he could do.
I'll go see him in the morning. I'm not so sure where Mara and Garth are at, but I'll pass along the invitation.
For the next few weeks, Clark visited Arthur nearly every day. Most of their time together, they didn't speak much. Instead, they sat in the quiet comfort of just having each other's company. Arthur sat still for hours on end. Clark, in comparison, kept having to resettle himself. In rounds, Arthur would begin telling stories about his son, recapping his proudest memories until he brought himself to the brink of tears. He would then return to silence for 20 to 40 minutes before repeating the process. Clark listened, staying present, yet he had little to say of Arthur Jr. Aquaman did nearly all of the talking. It weighed on Clark that he couldn't be more supportive. Laying down for bed one night, he confided this frustration to Lana.
It's just that I barely knew the boy. I don't really have any memories to reminisce with Arthur over.
Lana offered her perspective.
You're doing Arthur just fine being there with him as much as you are.
She let out a sigh before adding,
he's lucky to have so much of your time.
There was an extended silence before Clark brought himself to ask,
what's the matter? What's the sigh about?
Lana rolled to her side, facing Clark.
I'm just needing your help more these days.
What's going on? Are Martha and Kara not able to help?
Lana's lips pursed as she sought the words.
I don't think Kara has much time for babysitting anymore. She's pretty much the head of the Justice League now. We were lucky she was babysitting at all.
What about Martha? Has she not been able to help?
Lana sighed again.
Martha's here, but she can't really handle Jerry and Joey on her own. She's a big help to have around, but it doesn't leave me any time for myself to rest.
Clark felt there was more he could do to help, yet his cousin needed his company, and thousands of people around the world expected Superman to plant the acres of sapling trees they had grown for him. Clark assured Lana as best he could.
Just let me know what you need.
She took a long, slow breath in before she eventually brushed off the matter.
I'm sure I'll be fine. We'll figure something out.
The next day, Clark chose to stay home with her and the twins for a change. Completing all the chores with ease, he gave Lana a holiday. After lunch, she excused herself and disappeared into the bedroom. Clark found her in their bed, fast asleep, laying in a beam of light in the warm afternoon sun. Distracted by the glow surrounding her, Clark admired his wife and was happy to see her find some much-needed rest. He left her to sleep and took care of the boys on his own, while Martha offered her wisdom and advice.
I believe the best way to discipline a child is with a stern stare and a firm set of parameters.
Clark remembered the stare of hers. It wasn't something she had used often, but when he was younger, her approval was the best way to avoid it. He wasn't sure he had it in him to look at his boys with such ferocity. Martha's presence meant he didn't have to. She was a strict yet coddling grandmother. As Lana had mentioned, she tended to pay her attention to only one of the boys at a time. It seemed to Clark that Jerome and Joseph were intentionally distracting their grandmother to give one another time to escape. Without a second adult nearby, they would have succeeded. Yet Clark was onto their schemes and thwarted them each time. Lana awoke to find dinner cooked and the boys content, playing with Martha while Clark set the table. It was a welcome surprise. Though she'd been excited to spend the day with Clark and the twins, she'd fallen asleep the moment she lay her head down for a short rest. Throughout dinner, she proclaimed her gratitude, yet the benefit of having Clark home all day was short-lived. The next morning, he returned to his arboring duties. He had let them fall behind and needed to put extra work in for a few days. The next time he saw Arthur, his cousin's disposition had fallen into a dark place. The Ocean King stared off into the sea, muttering disdain for his son's killer.
He thought this would make us even. But this is just the beginning.
Clark was hesitant to respond, not wanting to encourage this thinking.
How does this make you even?
That's what I'm saying. I didn't even know Garth was his kid. I didn't even think the boy's dad was around, let alone that his pops was Black Manta. If I'd known that, I would have given him his kid. He may be a total villain, but I didn't want to take the dude's kid from him.
Clark nodded, offering assurance.
It's understandable. You were only giving Garth a family when he had none.
Like, dude, we love him like our own son. And what's Manta go and do? Says nothing for years and plots his revenge. It's not right. He took Junior from us like it evens the score. But now he gets what he has coming.
Clark's spine tingled with a hint of worry. This kind of talk was something he suppressed in himself. If he let himself contemplate revenge for his own suffering, there would be nothing left of this world that destroyed his home and killed his parents. If Clark sought revenge, he would become the very thing Luther feared. Instead, Clark suggested there was another way.
Do you really want to draw this out?
Oh, I'm not drawing this out. I'm ending it. I'm ending him.
I don't know if that'd be such a good idea. What would the world be like if I went looking for revenge over the destruction of Krypton? I don't think it would be pretty, and it wouldn't be justice.
Look, cuz, I'm looking for you to have my back, not give me some speech on morality. Now are you helping me or not?
Clark said nothing. His continued silence answered the question. Though Arthur tried several more times to persuade his cousin to join him in his pursuit of revenge, Clark backed out each time. After that day, he visited Arthur less, returning to his trees and focusing on his duties. Sporadically, throughout his work week, he spent a day here and there with his family, and each time, after lunch, Lana would pass out and nap for all of the afternoon. As the weeks went by and Arthur became engulfed in his obsession over hunting Black Manta, Clark lost touch with his grieving cousin. The forests of the world, those that Superman had planted, were beginning to shift global weather. Seeing the greening desert stabilize new rain patterns filled Clark with pride. The satisfaction of seeing one's work have an effect encouraged Clark to take time off and truly spend some quality time with his family. Lana could not have been more grateful to have Clark around. When he told her the news that he would be taking time off from work, she began planning a calendar of family activities. She regretted the days she had spent napping while Clark was at home. As she, Clark, Martha, and the twins sat down to dinner, she shared her plan.
I'm not going to miss out on this precious time when we could be making memories. These boys are growing up faster than a newborn calf.
The Kent family spent the next day at a water park in a neighboring town. The day after that, they went to a petting zoo and saw a play performed in the Danvers City Park, followed by another full day spent at the beach. For both of these latter trips, Clark carried the family car, flying them to scenic locations. By the end of each day, immediately upon returning home, Lana fell asleep before Clark and the boys, missing dinner altogether. On the fourth day, Clark suggested they all take it easy and spend time relaxing at home.
It's been a full few days already. Maybe we can all nap together.
You don't want to go to the Grand Canyon like we were planning?
The Grand Canyon isn't going anywhere. We'll see it another day. Let's just get some rest for a change.
Clark wasn't feeling particularly tired himself, but it was obvious that Lana could use the respite. Sure enough, she proved to be exhausted, napping with the boys in the late morning. While they rested, Clark went to Martha, looking for some insight. He found her on the back porch in her rocking chair. He sat next to her, and the two of them appreciated the view of the barn and arboretum, surrounded by a small, thriving grove of trees. Clark shared his concerns.
I can't help shake the feeling there's something I should be fixing. Lana insists everything's all fine, but she can never seem to get enough rest.
Don't beat yourself up, Clark. Having a baby ain't easy. Having two is twice as hard, and then some.
It just seems like something I should be able to do something about.
There's nothing to fix. It's just how the boys are, and they are something else. They're not like you used to be. They don't go and destroy everything, but they're on constant overdrive. Thank God they spend all their energy going at each other. Lana doesn't think I can handle them on my own, but they handle themselves just fine most of the time.
Are you sure about that? I've heard some stories.
Just because I lose one of them every now and then doesn't mean I'm out of my depth. We always find them safe and sound.
Well, maybe we can find someone to help you out. Like a live-in nanny.
We both know Kara doesn't have the time.
I know, but we must know someone. You've got an extra room here in the house.
Martha paused from rocking her chair.
You know, now that you mention it, I don't know if you've heard, but ever since the hardware store shut down, Petey's been out of work. He and Drew have to move and are looking for a more affordable place.
You don't say.
Hearing about Pete's misfortune, Clark couldn't help wonder if it could be a blessing in disguise for them all. There was little time to discuss the matter further, as Clark received an unprompted telepathic summons from Jean Jones.
Kal-El, I apologize for the intrusion, but your cousin Arthur is seeking your assistance.
It had been a while since Clark had heard from Jean. Ever since the Justice League had returned from the Gorilla City, they'd begun to rely less on the Martian Manhunter's telepathy in favor of the communication bands they'd received from the Gorilla King, Solivar. As a result, Clark saw and heard from their old friend all the less. He wanted to ask Jean Jones how he was doing and what he'd been up to, but instead, he simply agreed to meet with Arthur. Despite Clark not inquiring, the Martian sensed his curiosity and answered his unasked question by flooding Clark with a series of memories. In a blink, Clark saw Jean Jones and Mari Jiwe. She was pregnant. They were expecting a baby.
Congratulations.
Thank you, my friend.
Their communication ended abruptly as Jean Jones relayed the time and place Arthur would meet him. It was on the shore near Gotham, not many miles from where the two cousins had originally met. Clark found his cousin awaiting him on the rocky shore. Arthur wasted no time getting to the point.
Look, I know you're all about being a Boy Scout and won't help me hunt Black Manta, but I need you to take me to Batman. Dude has all the info. I need him to track down this low-life killer.
Why do you need me? Why can't you contact him through Jean Jones?
I don't know. Bats kind of creeps me out. I thought you might be able to soften him up a little, help me persuade him. Besides, I want to keep this off the books. The less the Leaguers hear about it, the better.
Clark held his tongue in his criticism. He thought it hypocritical of Arthur to call Manta a killer while planning his death. Instead, he agreed to accompany Aquaman to the Batcave and flew them both there. Although Bruce typically disapproved of visitors arriving unannounced, Clark thought it best to go with Arthur's instincts, keeping their plans to themselves and surprising Batman with their visit. As dusk swept over Gotham, the two of them entered the underground catacombs beneath Wayne Manor. The headquarters were unusually busy when they arrived. Richard and Barbara were out of their suits as Nightwing and Batgirl. They both worked to repair the exterior damage the Batwing had taken. Neither of them noticed the magnificent glowing beams behind them. They were startled when Arthur broke into a series of questions.
What's up, Babs? What's up, Dick? What's going on? What happened to the jet?
Barbara dropped her wrench as Richard hit his head on the metal sheet above him. They hadn't caught their breath before Clark and Arthur found themselves also startled. Bruce's gruff voice spoke out from directly behind them, where Batman stood, in his full regalia, only a couple of meters away.
It's better you not distract them right now. We're working on a tight schedule.
Clark almost spoke, but Arthur motioned a quieting hand his way as he took a step toward Batman.
Bats, my dude, I need your help finding someone.
Batman's rigid posture tightened.
Who is it you're looking for?
Arthur swallowed before answering.
My son's killer. Black Manta.
Batman didn't respond at first. His head tilted slightly as he assessed Arthur, glancing at Clark and then back to Arthur.
What will you do when you find Manta?
Arthur's voice edged upward in volume and urgency.
Isn't it obvious? I'm taking my revenge. He's my business.
Batman crossed his arms before raising one hand to massage his chin. When he appeared to have made up his mind, he invited them both to sit with him at a large meeting table. Clark didn't remember seeing this table during any of his previous visits to the Batcave. Arthur and Clark sat down, as Bruce removed the cowl and protective makeup on his face. When he joined them at the table, he still wore smears of gray from hastily unmasking. Arthur had grown impatient from the wait.
So what's going on, Bats? Are we gonna do this?
I can help. but I need to ask you. What do you hope to accomplish?
What do I hope to accomplish? I'm gonna kill that monster and leave him dry in the desert. I never want to see him in my sea again.
Clark could not have expected Bruce's next question. Is this supposed to serve as a warning for your enemies? Arthur was also thrown off by this line of questioning.
What? No! I'm gonna make him pay for killing Junior!
And how will you do that? Are you going to kill his son?
Of course not! I love Garth like my own blood!
What then? You'll just kill Garth's father? Arthur's words fell short. Instead, he dropped his head, forlorn.
That's what Mara said before she left me.
This was news to Clark. Arthur had said nothing of it.
What? Mara left?
She took Garth with her. She said we all needed some space. I doubt she's coming back. I said some things I shouldn't have.
Bruce leaned forward, reaching across the corner of the table and taking one of Arthur's hands in his own. Arthur, killing Black Manta isn't going to convince her to come back. It will only push her and Garth away. More importantly, killing him won't bring Arthur Jr. back. I've spent most of my life in pursuit of revenge. I can only tell you it never gets better. Not as long as you take that path. Revenge only infects our injuries and keeps them from healing. Arthur's voice cracked as he pulled his hand away, retorting,
But he killed my boy! He took Arthur from me! And now, I've lost my family. This is all I've got!
With his final word, Arthur's fist came down on the table, smashing through it. Bruce thrust himself away as it collapsed. Arthur's face flushed, tears forming in his eyes as he pleaded with Batman. Bruce looked back at his friend with sorrow. It won't always feel this way. Clark put a hand on his cousin's back and tried to console him as well.
We're here for you, Arthur.
Richard's voice joined in the conversation. We all are. He and Barbara joined them, sitting down at the now wrecked table. Richard, ignoring the mess, continued. Grieving doesn't stop, but it does change. And I can tell you, that fire you're feeling, it does die down eventually. It's just a matter of not burning the people we love in the meantime. Arthur took a few deep breaths as he cast his gaze down on the destroyed table. Wiping the tears from his eyes, he looked around at the others, saying nothing, but taking the time to hold eye contact with each of them. Finally, he swallowed before speaking.
Okay. You guys are right. I need to let this go before I wreck my life any further. Thanks, Bruce. I didn't like hearing this, but I'll leave it be. Maybe Mara won't hate me forever.
Clark gave his cousin a hug, and the others all got up to gather around and hold Arthur. The touching moment didn't last long. Once the hug disbanded, Batman put the others straight back to work, and Clark and Arthur flew back to the sea. The following day, back on Kent Farm, Pete and Drew came by early in the morning to measure the second bedroom in the main house. Martha had wasted no time. The moment Clark dashed off, she called them to offer them the live-in nanny position. This was a faster response than Clark had dared to hope for. Soon, Pete and Drew had moved in and were integrating into the family. Clark began construction on a small building for Drew to set up his wood shop, allowing them both to be nearby every day. Each morning, Pete and Drew took turns helping Lana with the boys. Together, the couple was able to be with Joseph and Jerome in the afternoons, allowing Lana to nap. All the adults took turns cooking each night, and for two nights a week, there were plenty of leftovers. With his newfound assistance at home, Clark was able to once again dependably plant saplings around the world. On what days he took off each week, he spent time with his family. Lana, no longer exhausted, could spend the days with all of her boys. As they picnicked in a grassy clearing on the Lang property one sunny summer day, only weeks before the twins' second birthday, Clark again received another telepathic call from John Jones, asking a single question.
Where are you at the moment?
Clark answered in his mind.
I'm at home, in Smallville. Why? What's going on?
Stay where you are. We will keep you updated.
Clark heard nothing after that. Though he didn't mention the message, Lana could tell from his posture that not all was well. Clark stared off into the west, attempting to look beyond the horizon. He could sense the commotion. Someone was coming. Clark rose to his feet to meet this visitor. With his acute vision, he could see it was Kara, but she was not alone. Pursuing her was an alien man, astride what could be best described as a flying motorcycle. The alien's skin was white as marble, contrasting with his dark clothes and wild black hair. A handlebar mustache framed his malicious grin, and his glowing red eyes were surrounded by blackened skin like a wicked raccoon. He gained on Supergirl, but each time he neared, she fought him back with blasts of heat vision from her eyes. These setbacks did not deter her pursuer. They were both fast approaching, but still far enough away so as to barely be visible to the human eye. Clark slowly lifted off the ground to get a better look. Little Joseph and Jerome peered up at their father in wonder as he levitated above them. Clark watched this man on the flying craft as the alien produced a chain of sorts with a hook at its end. Swinging it over his head, the weapon took on incredible momentum before he flung it at Supergirl. Clark watched in shock at the unfolding sudden violence. In the same moment the chain ensnared Kara, its master leapt from his craft, landing on Supergirl and pummeling her with repeated punches. The two continued to fall at increasing speed until he let loose one final blow, taking her to the ground. The alien bounded back into the sky, dragging Supergirl with him by the chain. His craft swooped in to catch him. It all happened in one graceful set of motions, over within a couple of seconds. Again, the stranger swung his chain, this time flinging Kara free with uncanny precision. She hurled directly for Clark, hovering above his family. In an instant, he burst forward to catch her. In that same moment, he took on his radiant form, bearing his family crest. Kara was badly beaten, limp but breathing. Seeing her face bleeding and covered in bruises, Clark's own face contorted in rage. Before this moment, he had never had to worry about his younger cousin being Supergirl. Her health and mortality had never before been under threat. Yet this foe was powerful. Clark could not let him get near his family. He darted back to Lana and the boys to leave Kara with them, looking upon them all with concern as he lifted off the ground.
Get somewhere safe.
Turning away, Clark shot in the direction of this new, quickly approaching threat. He needed to widen the distance between this attacker and his family. As they converged, Clark came to a halt. The alien visitor did the same on his craft, jumping out of the saddle and onto the front hood of the hovering machine. As casual as though he were striking up conversation, he spoke with a crude alien dialect, similar enough to Krypton's native tongue that Clark could make out its meaning. The alien spoke in a gruff voice.
Well, here we are at the main event. The King of the Kryptonians. Ha! Look here, my man. We can do this the easy way. Will you come with me, nice and proper like? Or you can put up a fuss, and I can gift wrap you like Girly over there. What'll it be? Either way, I'm getting my bounty. And Lobo always gets his bounty.
Clark fought through his burning rage to spit out an ask.
And who are you supposed to be?
The visitor raised an eyebrow, looking back perplexed.
I just told you, man. Were you not listening? I'm Lobo. Like, the Lobo. Last of the Saurians, Lobo. The galaxy's greatest bounty hunter, Lobo. The main man. You have no idea what a big deal I am, do you?
I don't care. Though you just hurt someone I do care about.
Well, I hate to be the one to break it to you, but I'm not the kind of guy you want to meet.
With that, Lobo flung his chain at Superman. Clark dodged it easily, but in that instant, Lobo disappeared from sight. In a blink, a shadow was cast down on Clark. The attack was coming from above. No sooner than he realized the direction of the charge did Clark feel an immense heat. A shower of fire rained down on him, pushing Superman toward the earth. Its force kept him from moving in any direction out of its way. Whoever this Lobo was, Clark reminded himself, he must protect his family. The rage inside his heart burned to the surface, blasting skyward from his eyes. The beam of pure energy cast off Lobo's attack, shattering the cannon that Lobo was suddenly wielding. Superman bolted upward toward his attacker, rupturing the air around him in a sonic boom. Yet Lobo parried him and mounted his craft once again. The machine came back to him as though it were a summoned creature. Again, Lobo threw the hook-mounted chain at Superman. This time, Clark dodged the chain and grabbed a hold of it. Lobo's jaw dropped in shock, eyes widened. Clark smiled, impressed by his own advantage, though his eyes remained cold and fixed on his adversary. Superman tugged at the chain, in an effort to pull Lobo off of his craft, yet the chain only flew toward him with endless slack. Clark marveled with surprise at his wasted effort, while Lobo had a self-satisfied smile. Yanking the chain, Lobo pulled his prey in with lightning reflexes. Yet Superman managed to spiral himself around Lobo's awaiting fist, delivering an uppercut to the alien attacker. Hitting him directly under his jaw, he lifted Lobo from his saddle. In the next fluid motion, with his other fist, Clark plummeted his enemy into the field below. In the very next instant after Lobo crashed to the earth, Superman pulled him from the dirt by his ankles and slapped him down against the ground. He couldn't let this beast do to him or his children what it had already done to Kara. With a rage hotter than any he had felt before, Clark unleashed a barrage of punches and blasts of red fire from his eyes. Lost in wrath, Clark barely saw the teeth he was breaking from his enemy's mouth as their face became bloody and broken. Lobo managed to slip in a sentence, a single word at a time, in between punches.
How about, truce?
Superman's fist stopped, hanging above his head, ready to come down. Lobo took this as an opportunity to bargain.
Whoa, boss man, take it easy. No hard feelings. A job's a job. I'm just trying to collect a bounty, but this ain't worth the hassle.
Clark let go of Lobo and slowly stood up. The alien's face was mauled. Clark couldn't deny it. He had perhaps taken this beating too far. Fine. Truce it is. But I want you off of Earth, and never come back. I don't want to see your face again. Lobo stood, spitting out another tooth as he rose to his feet.
Ouch, man, that's a bit harsh. But whatever, I don't care. You can keep your backwater planet. This place ain't special.
Lobo's craft came down from the sky and positioned itself behind its master. The bounty hunter mounted its saddle, scratching his head.
Hey, man, sorry about knocking your friends around. They were super protective of you, and it's a real shame they had to get hurt. I gave them the choice, but I really hoped they would choose the easy way. Well, sorry anyway. I'll just go now.
Wait, before you go, what's this bounty?
Just some collector, dude. Legend's going around the galaxy that the last Kryptonian is supposed to be quite the prize. No biggie. Anyway, smell you later.
Lobo grinned at Clark. His teeth were already growing back and his face was healing from Clark's beating. The alien craft revved up and took off into the sky and beyond the atmosphere. Watching Lobo disappear, Clark sighed in relief, trembling, nerves still on edge. Turning back to his family, he was stunned to see his sons were across the field, watching their father in awe. Clark's face reddened. He was not proud of what he had just done. Having Joseph and Jerome bear witness, it only made Clark's sense of shame burn all the worse. Thank you for listening. I'm Isaac Bluefoot. Book 2 of Son of El is written and independently produced by myself. I really appreciate you joining me for this story. I love telling it, and I want everyone to hear it. That's why I give the show away. Though if you see the value in what I do, you can become a patron. Go to sonofelpodcast.com/support. A lot of love and work goes into every episode, as well as a few miscellaneous fees. But besides helping me pay those bills, I really want to thank my patrons. It means so much to me that you believe in me. And to everyone who wrote a review, each one warms my heart. So thank you. I really appreciate it. This story was inspired by the Superman and DC Comics and characters originally created by Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, with additional contributions by Bill Finger, John Zakella, Otto Binder, Al Plastino, Joseph Samichson, Joe Serta, Mort Weisinger, Paul Norris, Bob Haney, Howard Purcell, Nick Carty, Robert Bernstein, Ramona Fraden, Jack Miller, Bob Kane, Julius Schwartz, Gardner Fox, Carmine Infantino, Roger Slifer, and Keith Giffen. Music in this episode was made by Scott Nice, Aldous Ignite, Chad Crouch, Axel Tree, Kai Engel, Blue Dot Sessions, Mellow C, Chris Zabriskie, Poddington Bear, Sergey Quadrado, Beat Mechanic, Jean-Lucas Galambro, Tortue Supersonic, and Roe. See the episode notes for details, and be sure to listen to the next episode, Chapter 9, Family Secrets.